Okay. Thank you very much. And also thanks to the organizers for this wonderful workshop. So I should probably first of all acknowledge the people who've contributed to this work. In the first part of the talk, I will speak about channel flow. And there it is, Chai, my PhD student, and Johan is co-supervising this project. And then in the later part of the talk, I will go from sort of invariant solutions to directed percolation in a, I don't know, continuous or discontinuous way, we'll find out. Most of the experiment in Taylor-Couette flow was done by Grégoire Lemoux, and in pipe flow by Mukund Vasudevan. Earlier work was done by Kerstin Avila, Schreyers, and Liang. And this second part is in collaboration with Mark Avila. All right, so let's get going. So we already had a great introduction by Lorette about stripe patterns. I just show a few examples here. So this is from our Taylor-Couette experiment. I just stop it here. So we see a nice turbulent band here. In channel flow, you can create them at will, basically. We have this zigzagging pattern here of stripes, and here some earlier observations by Prigent and Duchot. And there were many studies of these stripe patterns. And of course, you know, in the scope of this workshop here, we would hope that then, if there are these stripe patterns, there are also some invariant solutions which are underlying what we observe in all these flows. So what we've done is basically a numerical study of a plane-couette flow, and we took a normal couette simulation, but then we came up with an idea. By the way, this was done in John's channel flow code, and then we tilted the domain. So you know, you can just tilt your periodic boundary conditions in a way that then the stripes can sort of end up perpendicular to your domain, and we made it wide in one direction and less wide in the other one. And here's some numbers that you can read. Maybe important, so the Reynolds number here I defined based on the centerline velocity for most of the talk, at least for the channel part. And then we started edge tracking, and as you can see here, there's energy versus time when we do the edge tracking. So in blue are the runs that go laminar, and red are the runs that go turbulent. In between, you seem to have a nice level. And if you look at the flow there, so this is in different box sizes, we see a nice stripe pattern. It's a traveling wave, and we can converge it with Newton. And for most of what I tell, we'll limit ourselves to a small domain, which is just one wavelength that we observe, right? Periodic boundary conditions, obviously. But I suppose we could also do this in the large domain. But anyway, so it's a nice stripe pattern, it's a traveling wave, and it's the edge between between laminar and turbulent flow. So edge tracking. I should maybe mention sort of, I'll try to illustrate the route to chaos, how chaos first arises, and similar study, this is very close to the study we've done previously in pipe flow, Mark Avila's work, and also it bears similarity to some of the work in Bruno Eckhardt's group in terms of the universal transition bifurcation scenarios. So, so this is our edge state down here, so we can follow that in Reynolds number, either by edge tracking or by Newton. I think all these dots are Newton-converged points. And if we do that, we will find sort of the bifurcation point, the saddle node, and then there's an upper branch to it, which in this case, it's not all that interesting. Hope it's not my computer. So anyway, this is around just under Reynolds number 400. But as it will turn out, this lower branch stops to be the edge at around 420. And what happens there is we have a bifurcation and a relative periodic branches off, which you can see here, time series off, and here sort of a snapshot in the large domain. And this lower branch of this red marked relative periodic orbit is our new edge state from this point onwards. And as we go to the upper branch, so we followed it to the upper branch then does sort of all the dynamically interesting stuff. Okay, so let's have a look at it. So if we follow the upper branch at slightly higher Reynolds numbers, around 413 or so, we have a secondary Hopf bifurcation where we then have dynamics on a torus. Then at 420 or so, this whole thing becomes chaotic, and the details we still have to fill in. 10 minutes ago, Johan and my students sent me an email with an update on the bifurcation scenario. I was unable to include that, so I can probably fill you in later if you're interested. Okay. I just got the email while sitting in Lorette's talk, so I was... Okay, so you get chaos, and then you get a boundary crisis, which is probably the interesting point. So here, then, your chaotic dynamics, so this is energy versus time, eventually it decays and it becomes laminar. So we have these long-lived transients that we're all familiar with from, you know, pipe flow, channel flow, quiet flow, and so on. So this is the transition scenario that gives rise to these transient stripe patterns, at least for, you know, this numerical domain and so on. And what did I forget to say? Oh, I forgot to say an important point. So, in fact, this periodic orbit here, at least close to the bifurcation point, it's stable. So we can just time step it. So it's stable in full space. So there may be some hope that one could observe this also in experiments. I don't know. Of course, the boundary conditions here are still periodic, so one would try, like we would like to, find a localized version of this, which we have not succeeded in yet. But if we had a doubly localized sort of stripe part, then one could speculate that this could be observed in experiments, and you know, not only this RPO should be observable given, you know, hit exactly the right initial conditions, but maybe also this chaotic attractor could be found, which presumably has a much larger basin of attraction than the RPO has. All right, so that's something we may try in future about this. And then, oh yeah, okay, next point. So we chose a certain angle, and what I showed to you was an angle of 35 degrees for our tilted domain, but of course, you know, we are free to choose any angle we want. And then the question is, what happens to the bifurcation scenario? And I just show you the traveling wave saddle node bifurcation. So 35 degrees was the yellow one down here, I believe. And you see that the bifurcation point, if we go to 45 degrees, we are sort of finding this traveling wave solutions at the lowest Reynolds numbers. So in that sense, maybe 45 degrees is kind of close to optimal. And as we increase or decrease, the bifurcation point goes up in Reynolds number. And I think we checked one or two of these cases, and we also have this, we also find this periodic orbit close by and so on. So the transition scenario overall seems to be very similar. Of course, the numbers will change, as is, I guess, obvious. All right, but
Bjorn, yeah. A question. Why is that not symmetric about the... I am the chair. No, I am Beverly McKeon from Caltech. I don't understand why that's not symmetric about 45 degrees.
Very good question. We don't know. We don't know. Not sure. Or is, yes.
Yes.
Is it obvious then that it's not symmetric?
If it's 45 degrees, shouldn't it?
Maybe.
Okay. Dwight and Lorette has declined to speak.
I think Bruno Eckert would like to speak, yeah. If we have a second microphone. Is there a microphone over there?
Maybe you can repeat the question. So,
what's the stability? Bruno Eckert, Marburg. So, you pointed out that you were studying this in the tilted domain and that your state was stable. Is it stable in the tilted domain or is it stable in the full domain?
Yes, it's stable in the tilted domain, and yes, that's all I can say. It's stable in the tilted domain. Yes.
So you don't know the stability in the full domain?
No, we don't. Yeah. I mean, it would be a lot clearer if we could have a doubly localized version of it, and then, you know, but even if that is unstable, you know, the chaotic attractor may still be an attractor in, no, may not. It may, you know, anything could happen. All right, who knows? yeah, okay. It's probably not likely, but it's wishful thinking on an experimentalist's point of view. All right, so now for the rest of the talk, I'm trying to explain how we now go from these transient chaotic either stripe patterns, or it could be sort of puff sequences, to something that becomes sustained in very much in the sense that Lorette was talking about in the first talk of the session, so in a percolation type scenario. And the example I'm showing here is to stay with channel flow for a few more minutes is from channel flow in our experiment, which is 500 H by 4000 H. Should I double these numbers now in your previous convention? Probably. So then 1000 by 8000, which is a bit. Anyway, I don't know. This is in half gap units, so that I guess is well defined in that sense. Right. And these are just sort of random snapshots at the end of our channel when we perturbed at the entrance of the channel, and you see, you find some stripes at Reynolds 730, and you get more and more stripes as you go to higher Reynolds numbers. So the measurements we've done sort of quantitatively so far are to determine the growth rate. So that is shown here. So when it's negative, so zero is there, all that is negative. That means so we initially create a stripe of a certain length in the middle of our channel. And that in the end of the channel, we check by how much this has either grown or receded. And if it's negative, it has not grown. Obviously, it has decreased in size. And first, at around 670 or so, this starts to grow. And then these bands start to expand faster and faster as you increase the Reynolds number. And this observation of 670 is actually in very good agreement with what we heard about by Genta on Monday, who had a number of 660, if I remember correctly. In bulk Reynolds numbers unit, it was 450, but I hope I converted this correctly. And also Tsukahara's simulations, which I think are not published yet, but he presented them last year in Paris at a conference. They were around 670 also. They are not in agreement with the study last year by Sano and Tamai, who claimed that the critical point was 830. So of course we would assume that once things start to grow, then we're sort of above a critical point and things in a thermodynamic limit don't decay anymore. Yeah, if you have a large enough channel with many of these bands to start with, then if they grow sort of on average, you will keep turbulence in your system. Okay, so then we also did a very long numerical simulation in a domain 400 by 400. It's difficult to read, sorry about this. Starting off from a small stripe and running this for about 30 or 40,000 advective time units. And as you can see, the small stripe grows and splits into several stripes and so on, and the turbulent fraction clearly increases. This is as much as I can tell you about timescales in channel flow, that basically they are very long. Even here, the energy is still increasing, so we are not at any statistical steady state yet, which is where we would like to be to do any kind of these percolation type studies and measure critical exponents and so on. So timescales in this flow are very, very large, and 750 is already far above, well, considerably above the 670 Reynolds number that I just mentioned. So at the critical point, everything diverges, so there the timescales will be even much longer, right? So that is one of the main messages of my talk, that the timescales are extremely important and they are very, very long. Timescales. So let's move to pipe flow. So in pipe flow in 2011, we had this paper on decay and splitting times. I think I show the movies one by one. So this is a turbulent puff co-moving frame of reference simulation done by Mark Avila. And we just observe it, and it lives happily for very long times, and then suddenly it will disappear. All right, and this as we studied in great detail and others before us also. This is a memoryless process. So you can define, you can measure a characteristic lifetime, just as you can measure half-lifetime and radioactive decay. And this here is the characteristic time for the puffs, the lifetimes, numerical data in small triangles, and the rest is all experimental data. And now there's a growth process also. The first one is a decay process. This is a growth process. And the typical one at these Reynolds numbers is that you go from one puff to two, which is called puff splitting then. So some vorticity escapes at the front, it separates far enough from the original puff, and then you end up with two. And we showed that this is also a memoryless process, so we can measure a characteristic time scale for that, which is given by this branch here. And this is all in collaboration with Mark Avila and Dwight Barclay and Kerstin did all these measurements here. All right. What did I want to say? Okay, so from this we then suggested that once turbulence grows faster than it decays, it's quite likely that it becomes sustained, and we suggested there should be a critical point at round about 2040, probably a little bit to the right of the intersection point. This admittedly is a very indirect method to estimate the critical point, but nevertheless we claim that because of this super exponential, so this is a log scale here, faster than exponential scaling, this should get us very close to the real critical point. Okay, right below things decay on these space-time plots, and here they spread far above. So what else did I want to say? So why can't we measure this directly? So we would really like to measure this directly. You take a pipe, you put an initial condition in, and then you measure after some time if it has grown or decayed. Well, ideally, it should go some statistical steady state where you can measure an equilibrium turbulent fraction. So the problem is the time units here. So the typical time units that you have to wait for anything to happen close to the critical point are a few times 10 to the 7 advective time units. And by that time, these puffs had 2,000 travel with a speed of 1 in these units. You have moved downstream by 2, 3 times 10 to the 7 pipe diameters, and our pipes are simply not that long, right? It would be hard-pressed to, you would need a pipe of at least 10 to the 8 pipe diameters. You need a few of those splitting, a few of those decays until you go to some statistical steady state, hopefully. However, we can use a trick, which I will get to in a moment. But before I do that, so in our reasonably long pipe, actually the pipe is 8,000 diameters long, but we here measure after 250 diameters and 2,500 diameters downstream. We perturbed with a few different methods. Here we just, we had several holes in the pipe wall and we just injected like crazy to perturb the flow. What happened is, Reynolds number is 2,100. What happened is, this is right at a perturbation. This is now 250 pipe diameters downstream. You see nothing. Everything has decayed. You're back to laminar, which is a little bit counterintuitive. Same at 2,500 downstream, of course, it's still laminar. So then we put some sort of office obstacle in, and there, well, not too much happens, but occasionally you get a turbulent puff, which is this dip in the center line velocity. Each one is one puff. Then we put some blocking half the pipe at the entrance, and this works much more efficiently, so you get many puffs. And when we have an impulsive jet, where we just inject a jet at will, but well controlled, then you can just set a sequence of puffs that you like. So the second thing one should take away from this, maybe the main point, is that at 250 and at 2,500, these two lines are behind each other, not much has changed. So you put a puff sequence in, and you get basically the same puff sequence out at the end of it. So whatever you put into your pipe, and I mean, this is a long pipe. Hardly anybody has studied pipe flow in experiments longer than this. Whatever you put in, you get out at the end. So it's very hard to obtain any notion of criticality from this. You could claim, well, it's below the critical point. You could claim it's far above the critical point. All right, so time scales are important. So puff formation itself after we perturb is very fast. So this is 200D downstream, it's hard to read. Sorry, this is 10D downstream from a perturbation point, 50D downstream, and 200D downstream. We use two different perturbations, a jet and a push-pull perturbation. They differ at the first two locations, but when you get to 200, each one is averaged over 50 puffs, I think. Yes. when you get to 200 downstream, they all look the same. On average, all puffs look the same. And this is what we will exploit together with the memoryless nature that, you know, the spreading and decay rates of puffs are basically, because they're memoryless, are independent of the puff's age. So then we play the simple game, you know, whenever we start with a certain puff sequence in our pipe, this pipe is close to 8,000 diameters long, so the diameter is very small, we start with some sequence of puffs. Whenever a puff comes out at the end, we detect it here with a pressure sensor a little bit before the end of the pipe, we put a new one in. So we just want to keep the same sequence, and if this is true, you know, all the important stuff, the new puff will do just as well as the old puff, of course, individually different, but in a statistical sense, it should give you exactly the same answer, if it's memoryless. That's the whole idea. So doing that, well, this is just showing the sequence now in pressure pulses, so they go up, each one is a puff. That is the downstream signal, and this is the recreated signal, so we can recreate the sequence. All right, and here's the result. 2020, so 20 below the proposed critical point, we start with a certain sequence here in black dashed, and this is after a day and a half, it goes to zero. So it has to go through the pipe about 10,000 times, right? It's a pipe which is order of 10,000 diameters long, and so these are the advective time units, so you need a few, 5 × 10⁷ advective time units, and then everything has decayed, but you have to wait that long, right? And this would be hard to do in, you know, one actual pipe at length, but anyway, so this trick seems to work in that sense. We start with a different initial condition, does the same thing, and at 2060 we can start with, I think these are 15 puffs initially, they grow to a certain level and then fluctuate around the level. We can start with 40 or 50 and they do the same thing, or we start with 80 and they go down and they go to the same level. So as a function of Reynolds number, we seem to have a well-defined turbulent fraction that our which is our, you know, the statistical steady state that we were hoping for. So we can determine this as a function of Reynolds number. The only thing we cannot do at the moment, we cannot go much closer to the critical point. Of course, we can go closer to the critical point, but we have some problems to keep temperature stable enough to better than a tenth of a degree, and this changes our Reynolds number around in an uncontrolled fashion because we viscosity dependent on temperature. So we have to improve that, and then we should be able to hopefully also measure the critical exponents. So far, we are a little bit too inaccurate at this. So Reynolds number, we probably have a control of ±2, which is simply not enough. I'll get back to that ±2 in a moment. And this is then a space-time plot from these measurements. So for each run, we just put one line here. So this is space and this is time. And you see that this is for 2060. So we have sort of a dense pattern of puffs, which, you know, looks a bit like a percolation type model. And here at 2020, you see how they all decay. All right. So now I could try to explain. 5 minutes? I've 6 minutes? Looks more like 7, right? No? All right. Okay, then I'll try to be fast. So the question about what does all this have to do with directed percolation? So in this analogy, we now just, you know, if you wanted to build a discrete model, automaton type model from these sort of puff observations, well, what you could do is, you know, you take a grid, you put one puff on there, you discretize time, you discretize space, and then what we did, and this is different from directed percolation, well, it is still direct. Anyway, we'll get to that. We now read off the lifetime probability. You just pick a Reynolds number, let's say 2060. You read off the lifetime probability, and the lifetime will determine if this puff in time will persist here or not. And I picked here a spacing of 10⁶ advective time units, and here the first decay would be expected after 10⁸. So simply, when you have one, it will just persist up, you know, till much further down. And splitting is much more frequent at 2060 already. And so, you know, we just proceed. Splitting attempt to the right didn't work. And every 4 or 5 times, five times on average, it should be successful. Let's say this one is successful, and we go on, and so on, right? So the splitting outweighs here clearly. However, what can be observed, now what was missing in the sort of lifetime splitting time plot are interactions. We didn't have, you know, we just know the lifetime and splitting time statistics. We don't know anything about interactions, so we at least to my opinion, we cannot possibly get critical exponents from that. Here, however, we have interactions. Now, this puff cannot split anymore because there's one in front of it. Or if it does, it doesn't matter because it will just fill in already fully occupied. So our splitting statistics overall, here the splitting probability is much lower. Well, it's only half of that what we would expect for the two puffs, right? Okay, that's the main point. And this is also what we observed in these densely puff plot that I showed you before. These red marks are for splitting events. We had two splitting events. For this number of puffs, for this 10 to the 6th advective time units here, we would have expected 25 splittings to happen. But we only observed two because it's too densely packed, they interact. So once we have the interactions in the picture, this is now our lifetimes and our splitting times as you saw before. But now for the full system, other data points, here we start to diverge from the super exponential and it becomes a power law up here, but only extremely close to the critical point. And we can check this turbulent fraction now plotted for this model based on the real puff statistics. Here we get the percolation exponent, dp5.
No.
My eyesight is, sorry. And now this is ordinary DP. Here you deviate, I can tell later how we define this, but these are lifetime splitting times. Here you deviate much earlier from the actual sort of microscopic statistics that you have in the model. Okay, well, the only other thing I would wanted to mention are probably the Taylor-Couet experiments that we did that Lorette was already showing some of. So I just show, well, okay. So this here we can measure really the full thing because we have periodic boundary conditions. We made a gap extremely small. We have an aspect ratio of 5,500. And we can follow them in time, basically. The puffs, you see it here in blue are the puffs close to the critical point or stripes, whatever you want to call them. And it's a quasi-1D, like Lorette explained, just like pipe would be. And we get the 1D exponents. So in red is always the expected value from DP. And black is our data. And this is from numerical simulations, which were done in a similar fashion. So we get decent scaling ranges for all three critical exponents, spatial distribution, and the temporal distribution. All right. Maybe since I still have 2.5 minutes, I can show the 2D Taylor-Couet flow here that we want to measure in future. So here, basically, it's 2D because stripes can now grow in two spatial dimensions. So it makes it 2D. So that is in preparation, but the system is still too small. This is our old system. We double that in each direction at the moment, and it's still the workshop is busy with it. So I don't have any results other than from Kerstin, who is still, over there. Kerstin Abler's PhD thesis, so where she measured the turbulent fraction as a function of Reynolds number. And of course, as Lorette said, it's never a continuous transition because we have finite size effects. But down to below 10%, at least, it looks continuous on this. So we are reasonably confident that we'll find a second order transition in this. If it will be DP or not, it remains to be determined. Okay, so in conclusion, so in the first part of the talk, I showed you a possible or one sequence to sort of chaos, starting from an invariant solution and how we get then from there to sustained turbulence, from transient to sustained turbulence. It's a directed percolation process. What I didn't talk about at all, but what Mark Avila was talking about earlier this week, is that the next from the spatial temporary intermittent sequence of puff stripes and whatever, the emergence of fully turbulent flow is then an excitability to bistability transition, which also Dwight can tell you much more about. This is all based on Dwight's model down here. Okay, then I'll stop here. Thanks.
Questions, Javier?
Javier Jiménez, I mean, I noticed in your model of directed percolation, you had, propagation and splitting, but no merging. Is that because you never see merging? You didn't consider it?
This model is, it's still very simple. We want to put a little bit more in what we can measure in the experiment, which we haven't done yet. The main message was, if we only have the lifetime and the splitting statistics, there's no way we can get DP. But it is sufficient to just let them interact in a sense that they block each other. this is enough to get from the statistics to, of course, there are other interactions which we don't have in here.
But I mean, do you see merging? I mean, do you ever see merging?
Well, this could happen. It's hard to say if you then call it either a unsuccessful splitting. You know, some vortices may run into the next path, and one goes to two. So either you call it sort of a decay, unsuccessful splitting, or merging. You could call it a merging as well. Yeah. So of course we want to do it in the experiment eventually to, you know, to do the real thing. But the model seems to be sufficient to have this one type of interaction in there. It gives you DP already, yeah.
Rodolfo Stila, Harvard University. So going back to the Taylor Quet video you showed, if I remember correctly, that experiment has a very, very small gap ratio. So how fair is it to call it Taylor Quet? Because Bruno has a paper from some years ago showing that for very small gaps, you essentially get the Quet type instability, not the classical supercritical Taylor Quet type.
Good point. I forgot to mention that. That's why I put Taylor in brackets. Okay. I fully agree. So, but it's not very, very small. I think it's 16H high. But compared to the dimensions that matter, it is very, very small. You're absolutely right there. And the curvature is also 0.998 and so forth. So it is in the far into the Quet flow limit. Yeah, plain Quet limit.
Bjorn, can I just get Rich Kozel, Bristol? Can I just get back to the previous question when Harvey asked about collisions? Presumably, you never see collisions because the paths just travel at the same speed. Is that right?
It's not quite true. They individual ones on average would, but that's a good picture now. And this is exactly the same that also Dwight observes in his model. You get these sort of you see these diagonal lines.
Yeah.
So they interact in a way that they get closer and push each other sort of along, and in these regions, at least that's what Dwight observed in his model, then the probability of decays seems to be larger, right? Is that correct what I'm saying? Dwight Barclay, Warwick. Okay, so it is correct. So they interact to some extent, right? And they, you could call it they kill each other off, or they merge, whichever you prefer. Yes.
So you have seen that. You have seen two paths get very close.
Yes,
together.
Yes, I can even show you a movie from the simulations. Maybe. Okay. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Was very special in the same slide. Sorry, because I asked to see the same slide. It is experimental in the pipe.
Yes.
So you have a different space, you have probes and...
No, so what we have is, so this is always one observation, you know, you let your whole pattern go through the pipe and you measure at the end the time sequence. And the time sequence, then you convert into space and you put one line here.
Okay.
And then they come from the entrance again the next time and then you put the next line below. That's just how it's done.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. Yeah.
Nigel Goldenfeld, University of Illinois. So what does the space-time picture look like above the transition? So there you should get merging, like Javier was saying, that the trajectory should start to merge, because you certainly see that in the directed percolation, and the merging statistics should give you the decay statistics that you showed in the super-exponential plot above Reynolds critical.
I'm not quite, but this is above. It's
slightly
quite
above, right?
Sufficiently above, I would say. They get a little bit denser than here, of course. So the turbine fraction will go up, but you keep seeing distinct puffs in the spatial-temporal intermittent sense until around about 2300 or so, when the individual puffs start to sort of become more washed out,
right?
And then the whole game begins to change. And you have this sort of it's more spaced out in Reynolds number. It's not a distinct point, but you have this puff slug transition then. Yeah,
right.
Let's say between 2250 and 2600 roughly, you get more and more into the sort of expanding puff slash slug regime, until you then have fully turbulent flow at around 2,800 to 3,000, then you're on Blasius friction factor scaling. You first have, let's say, at 3,000. So
right. I mean, what we see in directed percolation is when you're just slightly above PC, it's very hard to really tell what's happening because you've got those critical fluctuations are so strong. But when you go just a bit more above it, then you start to see the merging being more important than the splitting. So the merging definitely does play a role.
But
and it's basically, because it's very coarse grained, it's sort of groups of trajectories, which I guess looks like those bands that you're showing there.
I guess this is why I wouldn't like to call it merging, because what actually happens, I mean, these puffs are localized and they remain localized. If you put two of them too close, one of them will die off, most right. likely before they run into each other. So you typically always observe a gap between them of about 20 diameters. That's sort of the minimum spacing that we found to be relevant in this puff regime.
Right.
So, yeah.
But in the Taylor-Couette, you definitely see the merging when you look at the world line.
In the Taylor-Couette, the whole thing is a little bit misleading because of the visualization technique. So here we have a 250 micron gap, and in that case, the flakes we used were probably about 10 microns or so large. So what happens is you simply do not, they just by the visualization technique, they're more washed out. So you don't see this sort of nice dip in the turbulent fraction anymore between these puffs. I'm sure that if we've done LDV, you would see much more discrete lines on here and not so much washed out.
But I think that in the Taylor-Couette, I think you're getting the right result, because when you're looking at the mapping between the hydrodynamics and the statistical model, it's essentially a kind of coarse graining. So I think that's why it's giving the right result.
I can show you for the Taylor-Couette. We still have some time, or then I have to open a paper. Just a second. Okay. I'll get back to that.
Any other questions, comments? If not, keep going with the paper. Oh, Javier.
Javier Jiménez. I mean, I have a comment, basically. I mean, taking advantage that I have all of you here, may I post again a question that I have been trying to make to this community for a couple of years. I mean, like a couple of years ago, we computed a boundary layer, a turbulent boundary layer, at high Reynolds number, in your notation, like 50,000. Okay, so it's turbulent and canonical and blah, blah, blah. And in the upper edge of the layer, you see stripes. And you see stripes which are inclined at 45 degrees to the flow. They look like this. I have no idea whether they have anything to do with this or not. And that's... That's a question. I mean, can you see any? This is a place where, because it's the edge of the layer, there is clearly a coexistence between turbulent, which is the layer, and non-turbulent, which is outside. But the Reynolds number is large and blah, blah, blah.
Hmm.
But it looks a lot like the maps that, Loguette was showing. And it's 45 degrees, clearly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is interesting. I'd like to have a look at the paper, but please show me. Back to the question of Nigel Goldenfeld, Illinois. So here is the picture from our direct numerical simulation in a narrow domain. So here there's no problem with visualization whatsoever. This is sufficiently far above the critical point, and you see distinct lines. So these things remain distinct until you hit that puff slug transition point. As far as I know. Okay. Further questions?
Yeah, questions, comments? Okay.
I have a question. Is the next speaker here?
No, I know the answer to that one. Apparently no. So John, I think, will come back and confirm. Can I borrow that a second? So John is going to fix this.
So we have a cancellation. Actually, let me look at this. So first of all, Dan Henningsen had to go back. He got sick, so Bruno's going to give his talk. But Masaki Sano canceled, who was our 11 o'clock talk. Okay, let me back off from explaining. Here's what we're doing. Bruno will speak at 11. We'll have our discussion at 11:45 to 12:30 before lunch. Then we'll have lunch. Conference will end 2 o'clock. Conference will end at noon or 12:30. We'll have lunch. The shuttle will then go to the hotel at 2. Okay. Let me say that one more time. As little explanation as possible. Okay. Bruno speaks at 11. Discussion at 11:45 to 12:30. Then the conference is done. We have lunch. At 2 p.m., the shuttle goes back to the hotel. That was good? Okay, thanks.
We could have more discussions.